Cause like a winter tonight, I thought I would always have light. The quick flash that you gave to me, so dark I could barely see. Looking
from wherever you are around the world, welcome and thank you for joining us. Today we're going to be exploring a classic case. This is part of our series of unsolved murders, and today we're dealing with the Black Dahlia. With me today is former LAPD officer Stephen Hodell. He wrote three fabulous books. Stephen Hodell is a New York Times bestselling author. He spent 24 years with the LAPD, where as a homicide detective, he worked on more than 300 murder cases and achieved one of the highest solve rates on the force. He is a licensed PI, and his investigations now in their 15th year have been featured on NBC's Dateline, CBS's 48 Hours, Court TV, A&E's Cold Case Files with Bill Curtis, CNN's Anderson Cooper 360, and the Discovery Channel. Let's welcome Stephen Hodell to the circle. Welcome to the circle.
Good to be here.
Thanks. You so much for coming. I want to show you a couple books before we get started. Most Evil is definitely a good book to start off with. One of the books to read on the case of the Black Dahlia, Black Dahlia Avenger 2 is another one, and the most recent is Black Dahlia Avenger. Definitely books you have to read. You will not drop them. I would say get a cup of hot cocoa and sit on your chair for a couple hours because you're not going to drop it. So, Mr. Hodell, first question. This has been a long time ago. This murder was how many years ago?
1947, January 15th, cold winter morning here in L.A.
It's almost 70 years ago.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of our audience weren't even born yet. So they're going to want to know, who is the Black Dahlia? So what was going on? Who was the Black Dahlia?
So the Black Dahlia, it was a cold winter morning here in Los Angeles in Leimert Park, which is like 5 miles south of Hollywood. A woman is taking her five-year-old daughter stroller to market, and she looks over to this vacant lot and she sees a nude body. Or she thinks initially maybe it's a mannequin or something. So she says, oh, gee, that's going to scare the kids when they go to school. So she goes a block down, door knocks on a house, nobody answers. She goes a little bit further down to 39th and Norton. Uses the phone and says, there's this mannequin or something in the lot. Police respond. The uniformed officers arrive, and they're horrified. Here is a human being, a body washed clean, perfectly surgically bisected at the waist.
Perfectly bisected?
Perfectly surgically bisected. Clean, washed, the body been washed.
Washed as well.
Yeah, the uniformed guys call for the detectives. This is 1947. Homicide squad comes out, and the body is posed with the hands in a very careful position, not just dumped in the sidewalk, but on the lot, hands over the in a vertical position, and the bottom half is neatly posed just off the center. Cops, the homicide guys are horrified. They can't believe it. They've never seen anything like this. Signs of torture. She'd been tied up. All sorts of things. So this begins what will eventually become L.A.'s most horrific murder case and most infamous homicide.
Wow. She dropped off there?
She was, yes. She was killed elsewhere. They quickly knew that. The other thing is that the press arrived before the cops.
The press?
So, yeah, the press. You know, they had their own radios, and they would listen to the calls. And they rolled on it, and they actually got there and took a bunch of pictures of the body before the press got there.
Oh, wow.
I mean, before the police got there. So basically, she's a Jane Doe. No ID, no purse, no nothing. They get her fingerprints, send them back to the FBI, and within a day, they get a name, Elizabeth Short. She's 22, from Medford, Massachusetts, dropped out of high school, came out here to, basically, this is wartime when she first came out in the 40s. It was like 43, 44 when she first came out. Basically looking for Lieutenant Wright to fall in love, live happily ever after. She didn't realize she was out here in shark-infested waters.
I guess so.
Yeah. And back and forth, she went back to Medford, Massachusetts, back out here again. Mostly during the summer, she would come back out. Attractive, very attractive woman.
What kind of social life did she have?
Well, she didn't really work any full-time jobs. She had done some waitressing, but high school dropout, kind of an ingenue, attractive, everybody, all the guys telling her you should be in the movies. But really, she, you know, the rumor, there's a lot of myth around the story of Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. And one of the things I had to do when I began my investigation was try and separate truth from fiction.
I'm
a lot, lot of myth was built on this. So basically, but they get her ID. They found out she had worked in a military base 40 miles north of L.A., Camp Cook, during the war. She had become their camp cutie. She won a beauty contest.
Wow.
And quite attractive. And in fact, here's a picture of her in probably just a year before she
she's very attractive.
Was murdered. This is obviously a formal photograph of her. So basically, one of the questions is, where did the name come from, Black Dahlia? Why did they call her that? You know, there was a movie that came out the summer before called The Blue Dahlia, which was Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake.
Alan Ladd, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a murder mystery, a noir murder mystery. And some of the military guys, she hung out in Long Beach. She was living down there, and she was going into the soda fountain. And the military guys there in 46 called her the Black Dahlia, which was a spin-off of The Blue Dahlia, the movie that had just come out a few months before.
Really?
There's the Black Dahlia. It was kind of their...
What was The Blue Dahlia about?
The Blue Dahlia about was a murder mystery, and actually the Blue Dahlia was a bar rather than a person.
Oh, it wasn't a person,
but
it was a bar.
No, but that didn't matter. They just... But the name stuck. You know, one of the reporters that started covering the story...
Interesting.
You know, called up the pharmacist at the soda fountain, and he got that information, and... You know, so you've got this horrific murder, and I can't underscore how terrible it was when the homicide guys got there. They were shocked. These are veteran guys that had seen it all, and they'd never seen anything like this. And I won't go into all the details of it, but she was tortured for 4 hours.
Tortured?
Surgically, wow. Yeah, tortured with a scalpel, a surgeon's scalpel. She was... cut various places. She was sexually attacked, assaulted. She was tied. She had ligature marks around the neck, wrists, feet.
Let me ask you this question. You were in the force for 24 years.
Yes.
Did you ever see anything like it?
No, no.
So not even after that.
I had 300 murder cases that I personally investigated. Nothing that came, nothing as bad as this. I mean, I had some bad ones, but nothing that would equal this.
Wow.
A lot of the injuries were pre-mortem, sadly, tortured. So, but the key was also that that it was a they were absolutely confident it was a surgeon that did it. In other words, it was so skillfully done, the bisection. It's actually called, there's an operation, a procedure that it's called. It's a hemicorpectomy, where you surgically bisect at the waist. It's the only way you go through the second and third lumbar vertebrae. That's the only place you can go without sawing through bone to divide the body.
So only a surgeon or somebody who dropped out of medical school or something like that.
That's right. So your suspect pool was limited
quickly.
Yeah. You know, with that. I mean, they were confident that it was somebody skilled in surgery.
Does it take a long time?
Yeah,
to do it?
They were estimating an hour to hour and a half to actually do the bisection.
Does it require a special facility?
No, you can do it in a
garage,
in a tub. Well, they felt that there was running water, probably, because you're going to have, you know, obviously, she was exsanguinated, drained of blood. So probably in a bathtub, in a private residence, or, you know, is what they speculated.
Before we continue on, I want to find out, how did you get involved in all this?
Well, I had...
Or should we wait for that?
Yeah, let's hold off on that, because... Okay.
There's an amazing twist you're not going to want to miss.
Yeah. So the case goes viral, and here are just a few of the headlines.
This is viral in those days.
This is what we call viral today, but back then there were six major newspapers in Los Angeles, and all headlines, mostly above the fold, and it went for like 30 to 40 days straight.
She was the main story for 30
to 40
days.
She was the story.
I guess he was a suspect still. Nobody knew a suspect, but he was on the loose. Nobody knew where he was at.
Right, terrified, and I mean, it was so horrific, and... basically, here's another crime scene photograph. Actually shows the officers in the vacant lot.
Around the scene.
And at the scene. And
it's pretty open. That's a pretty open... let me take a peek at this thing here.
Yeah, this area, this Lamarck Park, is about 5 miles, where she was posed in the vacant lot, it's about 5 miles south of Hollywood.
But it's not really hidden.
No, it was. She was right by on the side, just off the sidewalk on the vacant lot.
And that's kind of gutsy to do, isn't it?
Well, yeah. He was actually seen posing it. A witness saw a figure get out of a car, park the car, saw him there for about 4 or 5 minutes. He was about a block away, so he couldn't really make him out. It was one male, thin, tall, and posed the body.
The night or something, I'm assuming?
No, it was morning. It's actually, they found the body at 10 a.m., and it was probably posed there not much earlier, maybe 8 in the morning. So it was actually daylight.
So this person was either completely clueless or was really trying to push the boundaries of how much he can get away with.
Yeah, and ultimately we will discover that he posed it at that location for a certain reason. But basically, the car is seen driving off. It was actually maybe a little earlier because it was actually just dawning. The sun was just coming up, so more like probably 6:37 when he actually placed it there. But it wasn't found until about 10.
10 in the morning. Wow.
So it goes viral. All six L.A. local newspapers are vying to be the headlines for the story. And it eventually becomes L.A.'s most infamous unsolved murder. And we've had some doozies. So, you know, the Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short. Most people have heard of the Black Dahlia, but they if you say Elizabeth Short, that's not going to mean anything. And as far as I was concerned, my time on the job was from 1963 to 86. So, you know, this is 15 years after the...
A long time after.
You know, 15 years after the crime. I didn't even know about the Black... I mean, I'd heard about it as a famous 40s crime, but I didn't know the victim's name.
Did they ever talk about it in the department when you first started? I mean, this is one of the cases we couldn't solve kind of thing? Or?
Yeah, actually, when you go through the academy, they showed the crime scene photographs as because it was so shocking and horrific. You know, to all the academy classes, they initially show the crime scene photos. This is one of our unsolves. The Black Dahlia, that's all I had. Maybe a half hour exposure to some films in the academy, and I was concerned about solving the 60s, 70s, 80s crimes and moving forward. Not
and you had a lot of other
stuff
issues.
In the back, yeah.
Already,
so I mean, I didn't really give it 2 minutes a thought, you know, and so then what happens is about 3 or 4 days into the crime, everybody's running around trying to come up with a suspect and stuff. They try to trace her movements. And the killer actually sends in a number of letters, taunting letters, cut and pasted.
The Black Dahlia?
Yeah, the killer.
That sounds familiar. There's another case we're going to talk about later.
Yeah.
Jeez Louise.
Well, he taunts the police and, catch me if you can type stuff. Cut and paste notes.
We'll show you those in a little bit.
Yeah.
Wow.
And basically, here's one. He sends in a bunch of them, and then this one, he says he's gonna. And the note appeared on the front page of the newspaper, and it says, "Turning myself in on January 29th, had my fun at the police," and he signs it Black Dahlia Avenger. So it's a printed note that he sends in, and this is about the fifth or sixth note that he sent in. The others are disguised.
5 or 6 notes already.
Handwritten, disguised, in about a week or 10 days after the killing.
And was the technology at that time, are you aware? I mean, were they able to try to grab fingerprints off the letters? Could they have that technology back then?
They had fingerprint technology, but supposedly they were soaked in gasoline, but I don't know about soaked, but they had the smell of gasoline on them, and they weren't able to come up. Well, actually, they did come up with some prints. Whether they were the killers or not, we don't know, of course. They had some identified lifts that they were able to send to the FBI, put on file. So he promises to turn himself in, and actually, the LAPD detectives think he's actually going to turn himself in because this is the only one that's undisguised, the handprinting. All the rest are altered and disguised.
Oh, the writing was all altered?
Right.
Oh,
yeah. But this is the only one that wasn't. So they actually thought he was. So they waited, but he was a no-show.
Changed his mind, huh?
And that's exactly what he did. He sent a letter and said, "I've changed my mind. Catch me if you can."
Well, that's what he said at the end.
Yeah. And basically, so they go full bore for a couple of months and come up with nothing. I mean, you get a lot of false confessions, what they were calling back in that day, confessing Sams. They wanted their 10 or 15 minutes of fame. So, you know, yeah, I did it. And then, of course, when they say, well, what did you do? Well, they were.
Is there a crime against that? Like a misdemeanor, at least, or something?
48 hours observation at the psych ward.
Yeah, I think they should put those guys way out of psych wards.
Yeah, that's what they usually do. And then it kind of goes quiet and, you know, and calms down.
Did you know if they had concerns of him continuing on? I mean, were they worried this was just one case that's going to start going with the taunting? Let me back up. How fast were the letters coming? How recent to the murder?
I think the first one showed like 2 or 3 days after the murder. And then they came 2 or 3 days after that. So they came for several weeks. But then what he did was he promised to send in some of her personal effects.
Oh.
And he packages them up, and that's what he does. He sends them to the newspaper. He actually sends in her birth certificate, some photographs from her purse, some identification and stuff.
So they must have been worried that this guy might go again.
They were. I mean, the whole city was in terror. Mm-hmm. And guess what happens? 3 weeks after the crime, we have another murder. Woman is found posed on a lot about 7 miles west of the Dahlia crime scene in Los Angeles, West L.A., and it becomes known as the Red Lipstick Murder.
Oh, yeah.
And in that murder, this is an older woman. Now, she's not surgically bisected, but she's posed, carefully posed, nude. She's beat, not surgically bisected, but she's beaten to death with actually probably a crowbar or a tire iron.
So a different MO on this one.
And, well,
kind of
different MO in the sense, but in the sense not, because he stomps her to death, and he actually, the cause of death was determined to be her lung was punctured. Actually went through her rib punctured her lung was the cause of death. Puts her clothing on top of her, takes red lipstick and writes an obscenity FU and signs it BD for Black Dahlia. So this is just 3 weeks afterwards. It's on a vacant lot. The body's posed. There's, you know, and it was in response to actually, we probably don't have time to go into it, but it was actually, he was responding to, they were trying to get him to turn himself in, and they...
So I was getting ready to ask you, was the police talking or something?
Well, the newspapers put out a false confession, thinking that maybe that would get him to turn himself in, and rather than do that, he kills again.
Now, was the woman similar victim? Victimology was the same?
No. Older woman. I think she was in her late 40s.
Sexually assaulted?
And no, she wasn't sexually assaulted. Hmm. But the handwriting was analyzed. And, eventually I would have it analyzed. But they felt from the get-go that there was a good chance. LAPD, they didn't have what you'd call serial killers back then.
Yeah.
They didn't have that term, but they called them chain murders. And they felt that there was a good chance this could be a chain murder.
Not
killer.
A copycat or anything.
Some, you know, you get different opinions, but mostly they thought it was. So in the next, that was just 3 weeks afterwards. Basically nothing, that they're unable to get any really strong linkage to the Dahlia crime. It kind of gets set on a back burner and it begins to be forgotten.
Really?
After a while. But what happens is women are continually turning up dead. And
posed?
All different sorts of things. But here we see a headline, Unsolved L.A. Crimes Ripped by Grand Jury. So 2 years later now, we're into 1949.
What does that necessarily mean, ripped by grand jury?
Basically, there was a lot of corruption in L.A., okay? So the grand jury, the 49 grand jury said, you know, something's wrong here. None of these murders are being solved. You know, the gangsters aren't being arrested. And back then, you have to understand, historically, LAPD was a very corrupt department. Half the department was on the take in the
40s. LA Confidential movie.
Well, I mean, and as we get into my story, you'll see that this story here is basically Hannibal Lecter meets L.A. Confidential in Chinatown. I mean, all three of those come together in this story. Only the only difference is this is a real story.
Wow.
And so the press is saying, hey, what's going on? You know, none of these murders are being solved, and they're all what I call lone woman murders. The key that sets them off, we don't have time to go into all each separate one, but in each murder, the real key is the suspect is sending and taunting notes.
Well, again?
Yeah.
On each one?
Yeah. On there are actually, in my book, I look at 9 separate murders that occurred back then. I actually start in 43, a few years before the Dahlia murder, and go to 1949. And I look at 10 murders that all occurred in a very tight geographical pattern in Los Angeles. Here you can see the red are the victims.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
Okay, and so we've got from Hollywood to downtown to the west side.
Is that common for a killer like that, if he's a serial killer, to keep that perimeter so tight?
Geographically is a key marker. It's telling you that probably he may live in the area of this circle. This is actually about an 8-mile circumference in the circle, so it's pretty tight. And in 6 of these 9 victims, notes were attached to the crimes. Now, I never had one in my 300 murders. Very unusual, almost unheard of, where the killer will actually either send in a note or write a note or leave one with the body. And in 6 of these 9, there are notes.
And just to make sure people understand, 300 murders you worked on, because I'm sure you've heard of everybody else's that they were working on, too. They probably came to you, too. Hey, Steve, you ever heard about this before?
Right.
So you probably heard of 500, 600, 700 murders.
Never. And here you've got, you know, 6 of these 9, there's a note, and the handwriting is,
so what does
again,
that tell you?
Identical printing.
What does that tell you initially when you
look at
that?
Well, as I started looking at it and got into it, I'm saying, this is the same killer. You don't have 9 different serial killers tripping over each other's bodies. You've got one,
not.
You know, maybe 2, but more likely 1 killer doing all of these.
And what does it tell you about him writing to the police taunting? What kind of profile did you start developing at that
point?
Well,
I mean, as I got into it, you know, this was all about
wanting
to be above the fold, being on page 1, and his ego.
Oh,
he
really?
Was a megalomaniacal ego, no question about it. The grand jury is saying, we want these crimes solved, and LAPD isn't solving them. So they do something very unique. In 1949, the grand jury takes the case away from LAPD, and they hand it over to the DA's office to investigate.
Really?
And I've never heard of that being done before or after.
I've never heard of it at all, yeah.
Yeah, and the grand jury also wanted a lot of gangsterism going on. You know, half the police department was on the take back then. I mean, it really was a real-life LA Confidential.
It
really was. I mean, that's
sad.
That's the basis of that. That's a fictional story, but it's based on a lot of true events, the Bloody Sunday in it and that sort of thing. At any rate, the DA starts investigating the crime, and and then LAPD says, well, we want our guys to be with your guys so they know what's going on. So basically they work together, but it was spearheaded by a Lieutenant Jemison, Frank Jemison. And he starts reinvestigating the whole thing. He gets all of the reports and begins going through all of the witnesses and information. So, and ultimately comes up with a suspect that, and solves the case. He actually solves the case.
Frank Jemison did?
Yeah.
Did he know he did?
Yeah, he knew he did, but nobody else knew. They locked it away, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But
and Frank Jemison was a...
Frank James was a lieutenant with the district attorney's office. He was he was the chief investigator for the Bureau of Investigation for the DA. Now, the DA's office is a separate agency from the LAPD.
Well, let me ask you this question. If I'm premature, just let me know. Was it incompetence or was it corruption? Why did he solve it so quickly and they never did?
It was both. Okay. It was both incompetence and a desire to cover it up, and we'll get into that in a bit.
We're actually going to take a quick break right here for a commercial. I don't know about you, but I'm sure you're getting ready to order the books right now. I'm telling you, this is an amazing story. We'll see you right after this commercial.
Hi, Hey, welcome to Adelante. This is Adelante Recovery, and my name is Yvette Kuglin, and I'm part of the staff.
Adelante Recovery Center has helped people in dual diagnosis for 5 years. We accept most PPO insurances and provide luxury accommodations and 24-hour support. To speak with an admissions counselor, call 1-888-242-4450.
A lot of time, we don't even know what's wrong with us, and sometimes we need to get away to figure that out. So if you want to go for a little retreat out in Corona Del Mar, which is a confidential location, we're here to help. So we're only a phone call away. Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. We're going to continue our exploration of the Black Dahlia case with Stephen Hodell. His book, The Black Dahlia Avenger, a new revised edition, came out in 2015. So we were just leaving off talking about the different women he killed. I think there's 9 of them.
Yeah, actually, there's actually more like 20, but I break them into categories. Category 1s, which I consider to be definites. Category 2s are possibles, and 3s are probables and possibles. But let's just talk about the what I consider to be the definites. And basically, the key is to the victims is, of course, mainly the notes and the handwriting, which links them to each other.
How many notes did he have for each one again?
Well, there were 6 of the 9 victims, the definites, 6 of them had notes connected to them, either, you know, with the body or on a piece of victims. One of them was a purse he wrote the note on that belonged to the victim. So in different ways, some were sent in. And the handwriting is consistent throughout all of those.
And how close is it, each murder? Are they weeks apart? Or?
Well, no. They actually span from 43 till 49.
6 years apart?
Well,
wow.
They're going every year.
There's another one.
There's another one in some place. But geographically, they're in a tight circle. Basically within the Hollywood area and south and west of Hollywood.
Does that make it harder for you as an investigator because it has this lull all of a sudden? You have month going month after month. Does it make it harder for you to investigate compared to somebody who kills every week?
Well, I mean, yes and no. Basically, you have to find what it is within the crime itself that is the signatures that are linking it. Mm. So it doesn't matter if it's 3 weeks... Okay. Separated or 3 years, you know, it's there or it isn't there. And I'm confident that if they ever do DNA on these victims, because there's a lot of evidence that's never been tested for anything. They've never looked at any of these the LAPD. There are a number of myths with the Dahlia, and it's probably worth pointing out in my updated version, I talk about the 3 separate myths. And one of the problems with Dahlia is there have been a number of books written about it, fictionalizing it. There's James Ellroy's Black Dahlia, which is completely fiction, other than using her name. And problem is when they use real names and real locations and fictional events, the public gets confused. They don't know what's real and what's false. So maybe it makes for a telling of a good story, a fictional story, but it gets very confusing when you're trying to separate the wheat from the chaff from what's true and what's not.
I imagine so, really.
So, and there are three main, what I call myths in the Dahlia story that have developed over the decades, from the 40s to the present. And basically, the first myth is her missing week. They claim that there was a missing week, that she was last seen at the Biltmore Hotel on January 9th. Waiting for somebody in the lobby, and then it walks out the door of the Biltmore downtown and into the fog and is not seen until the body's found post.
And that's not true.
That's absolutely not true. I was able in my investigation to come up with a dozen witnesses who saw her every day of that missing week. 6 of those 12 witnesses knew her personally, so they couldn't have been mistaken. So the missing week, complete myth. And most people believe that to be fact, and in fact, it's pure fiction.
It's a typical movie kind of scenario.
That's right. And it's, you know, hack writers over the years kept stepping on and elaborating the story. Talk about victimization. She was turned into a prostitute.
I've heard
an alcoholic, a druggie.
None of that's true.
None of that's true. She was basically a naive girl from Medford, Massachusetts, looking to fall in love and live happily ever after. She didn't drink. She might have one drink or a glass of wine, but usually it was just soft drinks at the bars. She went to the bars with the guys, dated them, but no drinking. So at any rate, and I had spent a whole chapter in my first book, Black Dahlia Avenger, rehabilitating her character and getting rid of all of this, you know, crap that's been put out there about her.
It's actually very commendable of you to do.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I'm wired to search for the truth. I mean, that's, and the truth was she was a fairly, she was an ingenue, innocent and naive.
Well, it's terrible already. I mean, she's got horribly murdered, and to
exactly.
fame her is even worse.
Exactly, for the sake of selling a book or selling a magazine or a newspaper. And a lot of innuendo, too. You know, she was seen with a mannish-looking woman, you know, that sort of thing, you know, suggesting that she was a lesbian and all of that crap.
But you had a lot of kooks in this one because you also had 50 suspects, I think you told me at one time.
Well, you had 50 people that turned themselves in. There were actually many more suspects than that, but they were over the years, but they weren't legitimate. They'd, you know, take them in for questioning. It was part of the, you know, in the old days, the round up the usual suspects and that kind of thing. So anyway, getting back to the myth, so the missing week was a complete myth. The other myth that was put out there, that it was a standalone murder, none before and none after, that was put out there, absolutely untrue. The LAPD cops back then were absolutely sure there were at least four or five of these were connected.
Wow.
And
the same nine you showed me earlier?
Yeah, part of the nine that I did. They were, the press was, as you saw from the headlines, convinced that many of these were connected together.
Are these part of the nine, too?
Yeah, these are all some of the nine, my nine victims. So,
but they didn't have the terminology serial killer back then, he said.
No. It was, like I said, they called them chain murders.
Chain murders.
Yeah. So that was the second myth, was the, you know, that it was a standalone. It wasn't. There were definitely a serial killer out there operating.
Now, was that more, was that passed more by the media? Was that maybe try to quell the fears that were going on out there?
No, actually, it was it was from ignorance. Today's LAPD cops aren't familiar with even what was going on back then, so they're under the misunderstanding that it's it was a standalone. In fact, you know,
really,
as it's handed down, you know, it, in name only. You know, the current guy who has it or gal who has it is, you know, it's just she answers the phone when someone calls in and says, I've got a clue on the Black Dahlia murder, you know, and they say, you know, hey,
it's not still open.
Hey, Mitzi, take the phone, you know, it's for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, well, you know, no, they've stopped working it and, they claim they're too busy to take a look, but at any rate, so that was the second big myth. The third was that it was never solved, and it was solved, and hopefully we'll have time to get into that and
hopefully.
I can tell you how and why.
We wouldn't leave the studio if you ever did.
It was definitely solved. There's no question about that.
All right.
Okay. So now maybe, I don't know if you want, you know, to understand this story, you kind of have to understand how I got pulled into it.
I think it's a good time because we have about a little bit more halfway through, so I'd love to be able to find out how you got into it, learn about the suspect.
Okay.
Because there's some kind of strange connection there.
Yeah. So I retired in 86 and do what all retired cops do. I became a brain surgeon. No, actually I became a private investigator and I did criminal investigations.
Which one did you like better, LAPD or PI?
Strictly. Well, I mean, there's something to be said about having the badge and the gun. It opens doors. You really got to work harder without the badge and the gun. But I wanted to stay in criminal, and actually I did defense work, mostly. Homicide defense, you know, take a look at this case and stuff. Occasionally there is an innocent man or woman that's arrested out there, so
it was
interesting. I mean, it opened my eyes to a whole other side. You know, I've 24 years for the prosecution, the next 24 would be for the defense. Balance it out.
You saw more than you thought?
I saw a lot more than I thought.
Really?
I figured every police department, every cop did it the right way, the way you're supposed to do it. And so it was a real education. I actually discovered there actually were a few out there that kind of bend the rules.
Interesting. It's another show.
Yeah. And so I retired, and it was in the 80s, and it was part of that. I was part of that mass exodus in the 80s from L.A. I had two small boys, 5 and 6, 7. So I moved to Washington State, Bellingham, Washington, which is like the last stop before Canada. Put my boys in school, hung up my shingle to do work up there, and kind of quickly became the only game in town. They had never actually had a private investigator.
In Bellingham?
In Bellingham, at least for the criminal side of it. And so I was working for a lot of cases, and my boys went through middle school and high school and stuff. And about that time, my father relocated from Asia back to the United States. And probably this might be a good time to give about the first third of my book, I give heavy biographics into my father.
Sure.
Who he was, and
we'll find out later why he's relevant. But yeah.
So basically, let me give you the quick and not so clean version of George Hodel, my father. Born in Los Angeles, 1907, only child. Goes to South Pasadena High School. At age 9, he's identified as a musical prodigy. He plays his own piano concerts at the Shrine Auditorium downtown L.A. at the age of 9. At 9, a pianist beating out all the adults for these contests.
He's a lead.
He's also intellectually gifted. IQ of 186.
186?
1 point above Einstein. And that skips a generation, by the way. My boys are in good shape, though.
Are they?
Goes to high school, scores the highest public school record testing in California. Graduates at the age of 14 from high school. Enters Caltech University in Pasadena.
Caltech at 14?
Caltech at 14.
Holy cow.
He's going to become a chemical engineer. About a year into his education at Caltech, not only is he intellectually, musically precocious, intellectually precocious, he's also sexually precocious. He has an affair with one of his professor's wives at, I think he's 15 now. She gets pregnant, breaks up her marriage. She goes back east and actually has the child, which... A girl child, which she names Folly.
Folly?
Folly. And dad follows her back east, says, I want to marry you. I love you. I want to raise our child. And the woman just shakes her head and says, George, you've broken up my marriage. You know, you're a boy yourself. Go home. Get out of my life.
This is the 1920s, so it was probably not looked upon very highly anyway.
No. This is 1924, 25.
Just before the Great Depression, yeah.
Yeah. And he comes back, he gets a job, he lies about his age. He gets a job with one of the newspapers of that day called the L.A. Record, becomes a crime reporter for the L.A. Record at 16 or 17. He also lies about his age, gets phony ID to pass off as 21, and starts driving a yellow cab in downtown Los Angeles.
Still going to Caltech, or is he graduated by
now? No, he's kicked out of Caltech for the sex affair. Yeah, he's kicked out. A big scandal. I mean, they kept it quiet, but they said, we're asking you to leave. Starts up his own magazine for the elite called Fantasia, which he publishes out of his home from a mimeograph for a printing machine. And it's only for the intellectually gifted and the elite, you know, others need not apply, that sort of thing.
Others need not apply.
And very edgy stuff. He gets into using narcotics, opium. He's hanging out in Chinatown, smoking dope.
Doing drugs. He's kind of spiraling out here.
Very much so. I mean, very, you know.
He's devolving fast.
Remember, this is a boy who is probably, in my opinion, got an arrested, extremely immature. I mean, but with his powerful intellect. I mean, he's got the intellect of a 40-year-old, but the
maturity level of
maturity of a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
And but he's working for the L.A. Record newspaper, and he's riding around with LAPD. Now, this is during Prohibition now. We're into Prohibition. He's riding around. They're door knocking and kicking in these speakeasies. And he's going in and taking names and writing these tabloid articles in the newspaper with the judge scene with a young blonde, that sort of thing. Then he graduates and starts with the homicide. He starts riding around with LAPD homicide, covering their murders. And he's the same thing, writing the tabloid stories, the bloody ace of spades next to the body, that sort of thing. And he starts double dating with a young woman by the name of Emilia, and his friend is a guy named John Huston, who will eventually become the famous film director, you know, of all the classic African Queen, Maltese Falcon. At that time, John Huston was just the son of Walter Huston.
Just John.
Just John, but his father was a very famous stage and screen actor.
Was he?
Yeah,
highly.
He was like A-list back then. So anyway, John and George are double dating with a woman by the name of Dorothy and another woman named Emilia. And John is dating Emilia. And then a couple of weeks into it, they switch, and John and Dorothy fall in love, and they take off, and they go back east to Greenwich Village, and they wind up getting married. And Emilia and George are looking at each other, and says, "This is you and me, babe." So George, she gets pregnant. They go north. Dad starts pre-med at Berkeley. Goes through 4 years at medical school at Berkeley.
He's regrouping at this point, then.
Yeah, he's regrouping, and basically, he then goes across to UCSF San Francisco, and goes through medical school. Not only all his other gifts, he also has amazing eye-hand coordination, and his professors vie for him to be their assistant in surgery because he has just a natural surgical skill.
This guy's gifted at everything, almost.
Everything, yeah, and. Basically, he graduates, gets his MD in 36, has two children by that time. He's actually living with two different women. He's living with this Emilia, and they have a son who was born to him, Duncan. And he has an affair with another Dorothy, not the original Dorothy. And that Dorothy gets pregnant, and he has a daughter named Tamar. We're now into 1935.
So he's got the one with the professor's wife, then he's got one over here with Emilia.
Emilia's got Dorothy. Duncan, and then he's got Tamar with Dorothy in 35. And he's also at the same time, he becomes a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper.
Again, back to writing.
Back to writing newspaper as he's going through medical school.
And there is a moral to this story, so hang tight. I mean, it's already exciting as it is, but there is a purpose to this. You'll find out.
So he decides he needs some space, and he decides to take off, and he goes to Arizona, New Mexico, to become a surgeon at a logging camp. So, soul surgeon at a logging camp.
It's a logging camp.
Logging camp. They had the CCC camps during the FDRs. Basically, they were camps to create jobs and stuff during Depression. And he becomes a surgeon at a logging camp in the hills. And then he starts doctoring at the Navajo and Hopi Indian reservations in New Mexico and Arizona. And he does that for a while. And then he comes back, gets back to San Francisco for a short time, gets a specialty in venereal disease control, goes back to L.A., joins L.A. Health Department, quickly rises to the top in the next few years and becomes the chief health officer for the entire county of Los Angeles.
Where are we here? In the 40s?
Now we're into the late 30s, 39-40. Houston and Dorothy and John Huston break up after 7 years of wild marriage and heavy drinking. Dorothy comes back, hooks back up with George.
Was he still married to Emily? Or?
No. I'm not sure they were ever married, actually.
Oh.
and
I have to get a flow chart for
this. You do. My older brother, they hook back up. My older brother, Michael, is born in 39. I come along in 41. And my younger brother, Kelvin, comes along in 42. So now...
All from Dorothy.
All from Dorothy. Okay. Yeah, she is. Actually, I was a twin, but he lived 3 weeks and died.
Oh, John. Sorry to hear that.
And so the three boys, he's head of now of L.A. County Health Department, Venereal Disease Control.
At 33 years old.
And he needs, he decides he needs a mansion befitting his stature. So he buys a very famous home in Hollywood known as the Soden House, which is actually, if we can find it here.
Yeah, I think there it is.
And here's a picture of it. And many of your listeners and viewers may be familiar with it. It's at Franklin and Normandy in Hollywood. And it's a Mayan temple, a very unusual architectural design. It was actually built by Frank Lloyd Wright Jr., the son of
Frank Lloyd Wright.
His name is Lloyd Wright.
You know the square footage of that?
You know, it's actually, it looks huge, but it's actually only about 4,500 square feet.
Oh, really? It's pretty big back then, I'm sure.
Well, it was big back then, but the rooms are quite small. There's a whole inner courtyard that they count. Oh. So it's probably more like 2,200 square feet. At any rate, in fact, it's just on the market now for $5 million. If you want to go and check it out, go ahead.
You can send us an email, circleofinsight@icloud.com, if you like.
and so buys this house in 45. All sorts of interesting people start coming. He has these amazing parties, drinking, sex parties, very
He's
social.
Well to do.
Yeah, all of the top actors and actresses are coming.
How did he get involved with those guys?
Well, mom was married to John Huston, and she actually was a screenwriter too.
Oh, okay.
So when she came back out, they doing screenwriting and stuff. So between Huston's friends and Dad had a very eclectic group of people: artists, writers, actresses, and all kinds of interesting. Man Ray was a famous surrealist photographer. He was our family photographer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was living on Vine Street, just a few miles away. Henry Miller, all kinds of very interesting, John Huston, a lot of Tim Holt, a lot of interesting people. So everything's going along fine. Dad's the head of L.A. County Health. He's opens up a private clinic on First Street for venereal disease. He's in charge of the venereal disease control for the county of L.A., and he has his own private practice downtown. Actually, his health office is in Chinatown, wouldn't you figure, but at any rate, everything's going along fine. We now move forward. We're living there. We're the three little princes running around in this great, really cool home. Mom is this very beautiful, strikingly beautiful mother, she's the queen, Dad's the king, and it was magic time. I loved that home. I mean, it was just, it was like, living a fantasy.
Did he travel a lot?
He traveled a lot. He went back east a lot as part of his job as health officer for the county. He'd go to D.C., was the home office, actually, one of the home offices that he had to deal with. And everything's going fine, and then in October of 49, that summer of 49, Tamar, who you recall was born in 35, she's now living with us for the summer of 49 in the house, what we call the Franklin House, because it's on Franklin. She's living with us. She's 14. There's a knock on the door, and Dad goes to the door, and it's LAPD. And they say, Dr. Odell? And he says, yes. You're under arrest for incest.
Oh.
So what had happened was, in October of 49, Tamar had, a month before that, she had gotten pregnant. She'd actually had sex with Dad and a number of other adults in his bedroom.
With her own dad?
With her own father, yeah. Oh. And she disclosed to our mother, my mother, and she says, "Oh, your life's in danger. You've got to get out of here, Tamar.
Life's in danger from who?
Well, from George. Oh. She was afraid that George would do something to Tamar. Tamar takes off, runs away. So after about 3 days, Dad's forced to make a missing report. He makes with LAPD. He makes a missing. They find her hiding with some of her friends, teenage friends from Hollywood High School. She discloses. She said, "Why'd you run away?" She says, "Because my life is so terrible." I said, "What are you talking about?" And then she discloses to that she had the sex with the adults.
Huh.
They come out. They arrest Dad. of course, headlines, head of LA County Health Department arrested for child molestation, incest. He gets Jerry Geisler, who was the go-to guy, the best criminal attorney in the nation. He was the Johnny Cochran of his day. And Geisler, you know, had represented all of the top actors and actresses, mostly on sex, and beaten all the cases. So in December of 49, there's a trial. Dad parades a whole bunch of, they call a whole bunch of witnesses up, say she's lying, she's making it up, it never happened, she fantasizes. And ultimately, after a three-week trial, they come back not guilty. So later I would find out in my investigation that there are indications that there was actually a payoff to the DA's office of $15,000,
again,
which was documented in some reports. But anyway, he basically beats the case. Tamar, for the rest of her life, is branded a pathological liar.
Wow.
And, yeah.
Is she still alive?
She's still alive. She's not well now, but she's, yeah, we were distant for many, many decades. But then when I started my investigation, we became very close and have remained close since.
Oh, that's nice.
So basically a few months later, after the trial, Dad suddenly leaves the country, takes off, and he's in the wind.
This is in 49, 50?
This is this is in, well, he actually leaves in 1950, late summer. So basically, I'm unaware, and my brothers, we're unaware of what's going on about the sex. We didn't know. We're just, you know, what, 7, 8, and 9. And we're put into a military school, and basically, I won't discover this until I get a little bit older. When we start growing, Mom raises us on her own after that. So basically, Dad goes to Hawaii, gets a degree in psychiatry, becomes a psychiatrist.
Psychiatrist now.
Yeah. He starts counseling to the criminally insane in the prisons there in Hawaii, the territorial prison. It was a territory back then. Meets an attractive young woman, wealthy Filipina. They get married. He goes off to Manila, has 4 more children.
How many does he have?
Well, now we're up to, I think, 11.
11?
I mean, over the years, he has, in the 50s, he has 54, 55, 56, 57. So by the late 60s, he's living in Manila as his home base, married to a wealthy Filipina, has the children, opens up and becomes a market research expert, goes into market research. Over the next 2 decades, he will become the most important research expert in all of Asia. Offices in 18 different countries. Becomes the leading authority on market research. And after 4 years, leaves his wife, Hortensia, Filipina wife.
After how long?
I think it was only 4 or 5 years they were together. But he remains basically in Asia for the next 25 years. Hooks up with his office manager, a young Japanese woman by the name of June. They get married, and he operates out of, still out of Manila based and all over. Eventually, 1990, comes back to the United States, to San Francisco. Relocates downtown in a high rise on the 39th floor of this building.
In 1990.
1990, comes back. I hook back up with him, although I've seen him over the years. I was in the military, I was in the Navy, and I was stationed in the Philippines, so I saw him. And we were actually quite close. But we've become very close in the last decade of his life. So from 80, he dies in 99. Hmm. So from 1990 to 99, I go to San Francisco, he comes up and visits me, we become very close. And for whatever reason, I was his favorite son. I mean, go figure, of the 11, it was, who knows why. But basically, then on May the 16th, 1999, I get this 2 a.m. phone call from June saying, your father's here, he's collapsed on the floor. The paramedics are here, they just pronounced him dead, come down. I fly down immediately, do all the things you have to do to take care of a passing of a relative, a father. And this will begin, June comes out, she gives me a small little album. It's about 3x5 photo album that Dad had. She says, I think your father would want you to have this. Inside of it, so I'm going through, there are pictures of my mother, my brothers, me, Man Ray photographs of us. Then there's this nude woman with, young woman, semi-nude with this long black hair. And I said, who is this? June looks at it and says, I don't know, somebody your father knew from a long time ago. And when I'm looking at it, it looks familiar. I don't know who it is, but I had seen a movie, a TV movie called Who is the Black Dahlia, which came out in the 70s. And it looked very much like that, almost identical. And Black Dahlia comes to mind, but no real reason, you know, and I just kind of put it out of my mind, but it has that look of the 40s and stuff. And in the following weeks, I start talking to my relatives, Tamar, who's living in Hawaii. We're talking about the great man. You know, there's a lot of people, when the book first came out, they said, oh, this is a Daddy Dearest thing. He hates his father, yada, yada. And actually, when you read the books, it's very clear how much I loved him. I mean, I worshiped the man. He was this, you know, godlike, larger than life. You can see why. I mean, we were all, you know, in awe of this man. And
So what are you telling us here, Steve?
I'm telling you, I became very, we were, you know.
So what are you telling us about your father and the Black Dahlia?
Oh, well, so basically, this starts, I talked to Tamar on the phone after his passing, and she says to me, well, you know, George was a suspect in the Black Dahlia murder.
Your father was.
That's what Tamar says on the phone. And I said, what are you talking about, Tamar? What are you talking about? She says, well, he didn't do it, but yeah, he was a suspect back then. She says, the police told me when they took me into custody that they were investigating him as a suspect.
They were ready to investigate him before they even found out about the Tamar incident.
That's right. They were.
Interesting.
And I said, why have you never said this to me? Well, the fact is, our entire conversations between Tamar and I were maybe an hour over the previous 50 years, off and on, you know. Well, Tamar had, you know, because she was so sexualized and traumatized by that whole incest thing, she spun out of control, you know. She got into sex, drugs, rock and roll, San Francisco, you know, the Hungry Eye, you know, Bohemians, all of that, and was kind of like the original Mother Earth. Mm. So, you know, and I went, you know, I was the black sheep of the family. I became a cop. What can I say, you know? But we, you know, had never really talked other than, Steve, can you get me some money for bail? I've been busted for possession of marijuana or something like that, you know? And she was living in Hawaii most of those years. So anyway, so that's definitely got my attention. And I, like I say, I didn't know hardly anything about the Dahlia case. I didn't even know her name, Elizabeth Short. So I start looking at it and discover that it was done by a surgeon. You know, that Dad was a surgeon, but still, there's no way my father could be the suspect. You know,
sure.
That's what I said to myself. I said, there's no way, and I'm going to look at this, and I'll be able to show he had nothing to do with this. Absolutely. And then there were a number of warning bells that came along in quick succession that started my investigation. One was that it was a surgeon that did it. Another was that the photograph that resembled her, that I thought this could be her, it looks very much like her.
Starting to get suspicious here.
Yeah, and my girlfriend, I'm divorced at the time, my girlfriend sends me up photo. She's living in L.A., and she's sending me up newspapers from the front. And she sends this, the actual copy of this one that we saw before. This is the undisguised note.
Yeah.
I look at it. It's my father's handwriting.
You recognize it.
I recognize it. You recognize your parents' handwriting. Yeah. You know, your listeners and viewers recognize their parents' handwriting, and I recognized mine, father's handwriting. He's got a very unusual block print. But I said to myself, no, there's still no way this can be. You know, there's got to be some other, is he pretending to be the suspect? Does he know the suspect?
And the LAPD had to be really careful, too, because he was a prominent figure. So they didn't want to, hey, you're a suspect, right? Because that would probably put them in a lot of hot water if you
were. Yeah, well, it was actually more involved than that. And we'll,
I don't think we'll have time on this episode, but keep going.
Yeah. So basically, the handwriting, you know, did it. And then I discovered that it was a hemicorpectomy, a surgical operation. I thought, oh, geez, I've got to at least go down and take a look at this. I will spend the, then I go relocate to L.A., begin my investigation, go 2 years of active investigation, re-interviewing witnesses and all sorts of things. We haven't got time to put all of the linkage together, but bottom line is I go in secret to the D.A., a head D.A., a guy by the name of Steve Kay, who worked with Bugliosi on Manson.
Oh, yeah.
He's a top, one of the most respected D.A.s L.A. has ever. I present the evidence to him. I said, you know, review it and tell me what you think. He takes 6 weeks to review it all, calls me back in and says, based on your investigation, the photographs, the evidence, the exhibits, he says, I'd file 2 counts of murder. He says, I'd file one on the Black Dahlia against George, were he still alive. I'd file a count of against the Black Dahlia, and I'd file the Jean French red lipstick murder. I'd file that one, too. So I'd file 2 counts. He says, the other 7, interesting, but he says, I have a very high, you know, filing requirement. He says, not enough to file, but you're probably right on those 2. But he said, I would file the 2. So with that, and of course, I knew I'd made the case. I went, said, okay. So I wrote it up, went public with it, and basically that started the
amazing
whole thing.
So how did you feel about that, discovering this idol of yours?
Well, I mean, you know, for 2 years, I mean, I had never seen that pure evil in Dad. I knew he was messed up sexually. I knew that, you know, sex was a problem with him, that he, you know, it was very,
you knew that,
very
or...
strong. And I, you know, and I was always convinced that Tamar was definitely the victim. There was never a question in my mind. But the
they
evil...
treated you well.
Treated me well, always, you know, and...
And your mother was... treated Dorothy fine?
So. Well, I would come to find out that he was very abusive to her, but I didn't know it at the time. I mean, I, you know, when parents split up, there's always 2 sides to a story, and you figure, well, half of it's true, half of it isn't, you know, and you kind of walk, as a sibling, you try and walk in the middle.
Sure.
So, but at any rate, but the real shocker is that, so the book comes out, you know, a lot of headlines.
That wasn't the shocker?
Well, that was a shocker, but... Oh. But the real shocker was it blasted open some secret files in the DA's office. And we get into those files that had been locked away for 55 years. And what do we discover? We discover that not only was he the prime suspect, DA suspect, all along, but they tape recorded, they wired the Franklin House, secret tape recordings, and they got him confessing to the crimes. And... They put 18 detectives on it 24/7 for 6 weeks. They ran a hard line from the Franklin House basement with microphone. Now, this isn't a phone tap. This is actual microphones in the walls. Hard line, hook up with Pac Bell, run it to Hollywood Station, and sat there around the clock monitoring this for 6 weeks. And he makes statements like, supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, they can't prove it now, my secretary's dead. Well, come to find out, he was investigated by LAPD for killing his secretary in 45, 18 months before.
We're running out of time. Last thing I want to make sure, I don't even want to stop, I have to stop. There is a connection between him and the Zodiac Killer. There's a connection between him and somebody, another killing as well.
Yeah, there's actually a Manila copycat Black Dahlia that he's good for surgical killing, and we're looking at the Bay Area killings, and I'm about to come out with some amazing new information that will kind of blow the top off of.
Thank you so much, Steve, again for coming to the Circle. That was unbelievable.
My pleasure.
You so much for sharing the story. I know you were riveted just as much as I was. If you want to find out more about those other connections we just talked about, the Zodiac Killer and others, you have to get his books. SteveHodell.com is the website. You can go there, go to Amazon, get all 3 books, Black Dahlia Avenger, Black Dahlia Avenger 2, and Most Evil. Remember, everyone, our motto is simple. Wherever there's psychology involved, we're going to be there. See you next time. And if you want Steve Hodell to come back to continue the story, send us an email, send us a comment, let us know. We'll talk to you soon. And also, catch our web TV show, Circle of Insight, on TherapyCable.com.